This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show, Three Fascinating People. John Schneider, the actor who became famous with the Dukes of Hazzard as Beau Duke. He's in our community now in the movie business, and he's encouraging the rest of us to get as fit as he is. At the age of 54, he is in top form. We'll talk with John Schneider. Also, Hippolyte Landry, who celebrated his 88th birthday yesterday, the former coroner, 27 years he was in charge of the coroner's office in Baton Rouge. Fascinating man, Hippolyte Landry, who once examined Elvis Presley, and Hippolyte Landry traveled around the world in an airplane, setting a record by doing it in 23 days, and flew over Vietnam during the middle of the war. And Steve Almond, his book is Against Football. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we start with John Schneider. He was with us a few months ago, and he has taken our community by storm the same way he took America by storm in the 1970s on the Dukes of Hazzard. He's had an enduring career in show business, and he is one of us now. How's life in Louisiana, John?
I love it. I love it. In fact, I am one of you because I have a Louisiana driver's license. So Livingston Parish right there on my driver's license.
You might run for office next.
No. You see, then the best you can hope for is about 48% of the people liking you.
Well, sometimes
I got to go for higher percentages than that. I couldn't stand the drop in popularity. I couldn't get into politics.
I tell you what, if you got in the governor's race next year, I suspect that David Vitter and Jay Darden and John Bell Edwards would be shaking in their boots.
Wouldn't that be something? You know, it's funny. I'm running for governor on the Haves and Have-Nots, on the show I do with Tyler Perry. I'm running for governor of Georgia. Gosh, would that be hysterical? No, not going to do it. Forget it. I'm changing my mind.
Yeah, well, it would be a great reality show, but in this case, it might really become the real deal. You might win.
Oh, yeah, the show. I got the title. It's Running from Governor. Running from office.
Well, you're about the same age as David Vitter, who right now is the favorite in the race. John is 54 right. years old and looks a decade younger. And you say that physical fitness is a big part of what you do as far as the creative juices flowing and you're just feeling well and looking good. It starts with staying in shape. How do you do it?
Well, I'm actually in the gym right now. Every morning I start the day. This one started a little late because I had some emails to answer, but I start the day with a beach body workout. I've done P90X and P90X2 and P90X3 and Sanity, all those crazy things that I discovered when I was 49. 5 years ago, I had gotten a little heavier again. I was up around 230, 235. My ideal, my Dukes of Hazzard weight was 220. I'm sorry, 200. And the weight had just kind of crept up on me again. I was a heavy teenager, 15, 16 years old. I was close to 250. Lost the weight, got Dukes of Hazzard. So now, fast forward to 49, and I realize my pants are too tight, my belts are too small, and I saw this infomercial, so I did P90X. And during the course of that, not only did I lose 30 pounds, got back down to 200 again, but I'd written two scripts. All of a sudden, these ideas and the way to develop them in a screenplay fashion started coming to me. And I'd written before. I wrote the last episode of Dukes of Hazzard and directed it, so I was no stranger to it, but all of a sudden, all these things started to fire, excuse me, in my brain. I was thinking more clearly, and these very vivid pictures were coming out, and I wrote those two scripts, and both of them were optioned within a couple of months, and I started on a brand new career of writing. So I have to blame physical fitness on that, because your circulation is better, your processing and elimination of food is better, your skin is better, so I'm all for it. That's why it's such a boomy room in here. You can hear my here's some weights.
So what kind of a workout do you do on a daily basis?
Right now I'm doing a thing called the Body Beast, and I have about 100 people who are a Facebook group called the Addicts of the Haves and Have-Nots. I have a challenge out to them, and see who can have the largest physical transformation in the next 90 days, and they will win a trip to Atlanta, dinner with me and a couple of the cast members, trying to challenge people to get into better shape and then to stay that way.
All right, so if somebody wants to do this and try.
Well, they've got to be a member. First and foremost, they have to be a member of that Facebook group, which is pretty easy. You go to Facebook and you request to join the addicts of the haves and have-nots. But you've got to be a fan of the haves and have-nots. And a lot of people around here don't seem to have the Oprah Winfrey Network. I know Charter offers it. So if you don't have that, you should check that out. It's a great show. It's very much like Dallas was way back when, not the new Dallas, but the Dallas of yesteryear. And I play a really despicable, albeit in good physical condition, character.
Unlike J.R. Ewing, who was not in the best of shape.
Exactly.
You're Jim.
It's important.
Jim Cryer.
I'm Jim Cryer, yes. Currently the Honorable Jim Cryer. I'm a judge who is now running for, just announced in the series just before we went on hiatus, that I'm running for governor. So, good show. Tyler Perry writes and directs, and of course, Tyler's originally from right up here. I think he grew up in Hammond. So it's a great time. It's our third season having a ball doing that. And even with the schedule of the show, I hit the gym every morning, even if it's in a hotel room. Great thing about these programs is you can bring some bands, you know, the rubber band stuff that you get from Big Five or from Academy, and get a really good workout in a hotel room or in a very small space. So you don't need the 24-hour fitness. They're great, but you don't need that whole thing in order to stay in shape. Mm-hmm. So I just eliminated a lot of your excuses out there who are listening. Well, I don't want to join a gym. Well, you don't have to. Go get a couple of cans of soup and do curls with them, and you'll be better off than if you didn't.
But you say you have more energy, you have more creativity, and it's related to the fact that you're in better shape.
Completely. And I sleep better. I sleep like a rock now. And when I eat, what I eat, I process, because it's used really as fuel, which really is what food is anyway. But yeah, I work out every day, and I write every day. And it has to be... the fact that I'm doing this workout, that has to be why I'm writing so much, and my creative juices are flowing. I have some people on my team who are accountants, and they say once they started working out, they're better at what they do. Some lawyer folks who are telling me they have much more clarity since they started working out, ability to retain more information. You know, our bodies are machines, so it's no mystery. If you pour a liter of Mountain Dew into your truck, into the gas tank, it's not going to run very well. So when folks,
you stay away. You mentioned Mountain Dew. Do you stay away from sugar?
I use honey. I always have. I use honey in my coffee. I do drink coffee. I do drink. I drink beer. I drink. I like a nice scotch. But I do stay away from processed sugar, but I kind of naturally stay away from that. I don't drink any soft drinks, but that never has really been a problem for me. Although when I go to the movies, I'll have a medium Sprite and a popcorn, just because it's a movie thing. But so many people I find that will drink diet soda. Soda. I'm from New York. We call it soda. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You may call it pop. But they'll drink diet soft drinks and thinking they're doing something good for their bodies, and they're just not. So I came up with this thing called the Simple 7-Step Soda Solution that you can go to YouTube and check it out. It's very easy. It's a way to wean you off of your soft drinks or your sweet tea, which I think has about 6 tablespoons of sugar in a serving. I know I'm speaking against the preferred drink of the South when I say sweet tea is bad, but come on. Give me a liter of sweet tea and some fried chicken. Okay. No wonder you can't think and you can't get off the couch. So I think because I was a heavy child, I'm really enjoying helping people get into better shape.
Mm-hmm.
My beach body team is called Team Ripped Duke, and there's about 600 people in it, and collectively they've lost over 6,000 pounds. So that feels really good. There are people on my team who will, in fact, be able to spend more quality time with their children and grandchildren because they signed up. They'll have more and better time here on this planet to spend time with those that they love. So feels good.
Mm-hmm. I don't know of anybody, John, who's had a more varied career than you. Last time we of course, mentioned your singing career, but you've not only been a top singer, but an actor, a stunt driver, a screenwriter, a film producer, a director. You've done it all.
Well, thank you. When I started back in the 60s with a Super 8 camera and some little 8 and 9 year old friends of mine making movies in the backyard, I felt like I was a filmmaker. And that's what I really wanted to do. That's what I believe my design is to be a filmmaker, a storyteller. And somewhere along the line, Dukes is great and all these other things are great, but I realized when I turned 50 that I'd spent the first half of my first 100 years, other than that episode of Dukes that I wrote and directed, helping other people tell their stories. And that's a noble cause, but I have stories. You know, I have stories and perspectives and odd little quirks that I've picked up throughout my life that help tell stories that I want to share with people. So in many regards, I feel like I've just woken up and smelled the coffee, and I've really just started my career when I purchased this place out here and Holden when Camp Singing Waters became the studio for myself and my friends to tell our stories. So it seems like it's been a long and amazing and wonderful career, but in many regards, it seems like I've just started.
Where do you see the next 5 or 10 years bringing you?
Two movies a year here out of the studio for my group of people. And during the off time, because that'll take probably 8 months a year, and the rest of the time will be likely doing the haves and have-nots. I have no... There's no indication that that's even going to slow down. It just gets bigger and bigger every season. So I think that'll be it. I'll be here with my eclectic group of artisans, making two movies a year in Louisiana, and then a month and a half or so out there in Atlanta with Tyler and that group of people. And then maybe on a cruise or something, or playing golf for a couple of weeks. But I've got to tell my stories.
Well, I'm glad you're telling them with us. And
I love it here. Louisiana's been fantastic for me. The craftsmanship here is great. The talent pool here is great. Yes, the tax credits are great, but tax credits without the talent to back them up really would be empty. And they're not empty. This is a fantastic place. From the guys and girls at the 13th Gate to my friends over at CFX to the great folks that run and operate Celtic Studios. I mean, it's really been an eye-opening experience, and I'm loving every minute of it.
Well, John, it's a pleasure, and I hope we visit again soon. You're quite a gentleman and an amazing talent, and we're glad you're one of us.
Thank you. Hey, let me throw my website out there. If you're interested in getting in the best shape of your life, just go check out thejohnschneider.com and click on the picture of me in the gym. Okay? Thejohnschneider.com. And that's only because somebody else bought johnschneider.com and tried to sell it to me.
All right. Thank you, my friend.
Have a great day.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our guest at this time is one of the most remarkable people to ever inhabit this community, Dr. Hippolyte Landry. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How are you this morning?
Doing well. Who celebrated a birthday yesterday. Born September 17th, 1926.
Yes, sir. I told everyone that I was celebrating the 49th anniversary of my 39th birthday, and that usually throws everybody for a loop.
Let's see, 49 plus 39. I did go to LSU, but I think that's 88.
That's it.
So it's 88 and in the gate for Hippolyte Landry, who's still flying planes.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. But 1926, where were you born? In Baton Rouge, but not at a hospital, I don't think.
No, sir. I was born on in the front room of a home on St. Charles Street, about four blocks from downtown Baton Rouge, by Dr. H.W.A. Lee. And I was very fortunate, Jim, but when I came back to Baton Rouge to practice medicine in 62, met Dr. Lee. He was still living, and he also delivered two of my sisters who were born right around the corner on Pendlebury Street, which was the mode in those days, but that's how it was done. Very few went to the hospital.
Right around your birthday, Huey Long is shot at the Capitol, not far from where you were born. Do you remember that?
Very well. I remember the paper boys saying the extra reel about it, you know, in the street and all that.
How was that time? That was an interesting time for sure.
It was a good time. I was 9 years old, and I lived on Olive Street then, 1644 Olive Street. I lived there for about 11 years, and it was a good time. I was in high school, went to Catholic High. My father directed the Catholic High School band, and my mother was a school teacher. She taught in public schools. In fact, she taught me in the first grade.
Well, your mind is sharp, and it's probably because you have so many interests, not only a medical doctor, but also an accomplished musician. And you've been flying planes for how long?
50 years. It's hard to believe. I started in 1964.
And a few years after you started, you set a world record flying.
Yeah, I'd been flying 5 years when I did that. I look back, I still don't know how I got it all together in 5 years, but I did.
Flew around the world.
Yes, sir. Solo.
You're solo in record time.
Yes, sir.
And above a war zone.
Yes, well, it was a movie actress from England, Sheila Scott, held the world's record at that time for a weight class. We were limited by the weight of the airplane, which was a certain class, and you could not weigh over 3,858 pounds. So that limited you to a single-engine airplane. And So she had been around the world in 26 days, and so I set my sights on that, and I went around in 23 days.
In 23 days, and you flew over Vietnam during the war when bombs were falling.
I flew over around May the 18th of 69, and it was a very dumb thing as I look back, but thank God nothing happened. But I was in Bangkok. I was halfway around the world. I was going to miss Vietnam and go south down to Singapore, and then from Singapore fly up to Manila. But the whole Malaysian peninsula was covered with thunderstorms, and I'd almost gotten killed in two thunderstorms 2 days before between Karachi, Pakistan, and New Delhi, India. I'd gotten into two bad thunderstorms, and it beat me all around. And I wanted to miss those, so I talked to the people that were in Bangkok on rest and recuperation, and they told me that they would fight till about 4 or 5 in the morning and then sleep till 9 or 10. So that was my window that I took, and
you,
there was
you made
nothing.
It through. I bet the heart was going faster than usual.
Probably not. You know, I took it all in stride. I really never got excited about anything. I just did it.
Mm-hmm. How was the feeling when you touched down in Baton Rouge 23 days after going around the world?
Oh, it was delightful. In fact, I had a good contingency of people that met me out there. We had a big party, and at that same time, the people that landed on the moon that weekend when I got back was the first time, and that took away some of my thunder, because that's all the news was about the people. That weekend. That summer, that's when the people walked on the moon in 69.
So in the same weekend in 1969, Neil Armstrong lands on the moon with Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins. Ted Kennedy drives off Chappaquiddick and ends his political career in the life of Mary Jo Kopechne. And Hippolyte Landry touches down in Baton Rouge 23 days after flying around, starting his journey around the world.
Yes,
quite
sir.
A time.
The rule was that in those, and it still is, that you have to weigh under 3,858 pounds, and you have to go completely around the world, come back to the place where you started, and either land there or pass there. And you have to have gone a distance of 22,800 miles, which is the circumference of the Earth at the Tropic of Cancer, which is almost the equator. And I went 25,500 miles in my trip, so it was all certified. And but that record has been broken since then by several people.
Well, why did you do it? Because you could?
I suppose so, Jim. I don't know any other reason, I guess. I had a beautiful airplane that was capable of doing it. Well, I do know why, really. When I look back, I was reading a little magazine one day called Air Facts, which isn't printed anymore. And it was about a man who I met later on named Russell Rink, who was flying a Bonanza from California to Honolulu. He just wanted to do that. And I read of his flight. And he took off from San Francisco late in the afternoon, and it got dark, and he was flying a slower plane than I had, but he was only going one trip, 2,400 miles. But as I read that book, my heart started beating faster, and it just got more and more exciting, and that just started a bug growing, I guess, and I went from there.
And then 27 years as the coroner
in
East Baton Rouge Parish. That must have been quite an adventure, and I'm sure you're asked more than once. You saw a lot of people at the end of life.
Yes, sir. It was quite an experience. I enjoyed it very much. It was time to retire, but I love the job, and I love meeting the people that do all the work, that the police and the court system and everybody involved, and the hospitals. And it was a very good, interesting job, and I enjoyed it very much. And it's being done real well now. We have a good coroner. Dr. Bo Clark is doing real fine right now.
How many death certificates did you sign through the years, do you know?
Oh, gracious. I don't know, Jim. About towards the end of in one period there, it was about 2,500 death certificates in a certain period. But in that same period of time, I examined the same amount, 2,500 patients with a mental illness or an alcohol problem or a drug problem. Most people don't really know this until they have a problem, but the coroner in Louisiana is responsible for the involuntary commitment of the mentally ill and the alcoholic and the drug abuser. And that compromises 50% of the work of the coroner in my work here in Baton Rouge.
We're visiting with Dr. Hippolyte Landry. Yesterday, he turned 88 years old, and as you can hear, he is still at the top of his game and is still flying airplanes at 88. Are people trying to discourage you from doing that?
No, not at all. No, pass the medical, and I fly. I don't have any problem at
all. I'd rather ride with you at 88 than some people at 28.
Well, flying is very safe. There's nothing dangerous about it at all. It's much more dangerous to be on the highway than it is to be flying.
It is.
Particularly now in Baton Rouge.
Of course, if you have an accident, though, the odds might be a little better on airline highway than above the skies of Vietnam.
Well, yes. Yeah.
But you've had a life, as I stated, like that few men or women in the world in any time could equal. And you've had a few patients who were breathing alive and well when tending to them, including a guy named Elvis Aaron Presley. I can't even say his name. I'm thinking about Hippolyte working on the King of Rock and Roll not long before he died. How was that experience?
Oh, it was exciting. It was, to say the least, anybody that would have an opportunity to meet Elvis, you know, would be very happy. I was attending a social function for the medical community in Baton Rouge, and the police chief. A kidder called me up and told me that Elvis was in the hotel, the Hilton, out there and could not perform. And they had 10,000 people out at LSU waiting for him to perform. And they wanted some doctor who was credible to the community to examine him. So I did. I went out to the Hilton I went up to the 15th floor gym, and I got off the elevator, and all these women were standing there with these big hairdos way up in the air and eyelashes sticking way out and fancy dresses. They were getting ready to go out to LSU to perform. And so they introduced me to Mr. Hep Presley, and we walked in the back, and I said, Mr. Presley, you know, I play the guitar too. I said, I'm not quite as good as you. And so he laughed, and he was very cordial.
Well, this was shortly before he died. As I recall, he canceled the concert, and then he did a makeup concert here within a few months of his death. And by that time, as we saw the photos, he was bloated and looked unhealthy. But when you examined him, I'm sure it was without clothes. Was he looking like he was at death's door?
I did not think that. A lot of people ask me that, and they ask me, was he overweight? No, I didn't notice that. I examined him. You know, I looked in his ears, and I listened to his chest and his heart, and he had a little, he had an infection in his right ear, and he had a little rattle in his chest, and his fever was elevated. I took his temperature. And that didn't enter my mind at all. And I didn't think anything like that at all, mm-hmm. examining him.
And it must have been a bit heady to think, you know, I've worked on a lot of people, most of them dead, and here I am examining Elvis Presley.
Well, you say worked on most people, a lot of them dead. That's not true, Jim. I was in private practice of medicine for 40 years, you know, and I had a good private practice. I had a lot of patients, and I did surgery, and I said broken bones. I did everything, you know.
So
I
was not surprised.
Very active in the emergency room. So no, he was just another patient, and mm-hmm. he was a good patient. He was very cordial, and that was it.
When you do an autopsy, how is that process? How long does it take, and where do you start?
Well, it depends on what you're doing. If somebody's got a gunshot wound, you go look to see where the bullet went. If it's a bullet wound to the head, you just examine the head. You look at the rest of the body, but you only have to find that bullet. If it's got six bullets in the body, well, you've got to find all of those bullets, and you've got to find out the trajectory, how they went through the body and what they hit, if you can, because all of that can become unimportant. And particularly if they were shot by more than one gun, then maybe you have a real problem. But there are all kinds of autopsies. If a person just say he's 40 years old and he dies, well, that's an autopsy that has to be done by a professional doctor who is trained in that. And I didn't do that type of autopsy. That would take a certain training to determine why that person died. And all I did were trauma victims, and I didn't do many. I had other doctors to do most of them.
It's an art, though, isn't it?
Well, yes, yeah, it's an art, certainly, yes.
Yeah. Well, Hippolyte did it all as a doctor, and 27 years he was the coroner for East Baton Rouge Parish, and I'm sure you dealt with people who died of drug overdoses as well. How do you generally determine that cause?
Well, again, that can be a very complicated thing. You have to do blood chemistries on what they have in their blood, mm-hmm. the physical condition of the body, whether the drugs caused them to go into heart failure or respiratory failure. So all of that is a very complicated process, Jim. And sometimes it takes a lot more than one person to do it. It's a good idea to have two doctors, mm-hmm. sometimes three, doing it if it's dependent on what's going on.
Well, talk about a man who worked with his hands. Hippolyte did it on a regular basis as a doctor. You were a pilot and still are. And, as I stated, an accomplished musician.
Well, I don't know about accomplished. I play a lot of instruments. I play practically all of them. I collect them all. But I enjoy it. I play all the time. I play with different groups. And I played the piano for a little while this morning. In fact, during the night last night, I woke up and played the piano for about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. Went back to sleep.
What was the biggest case when you were coroner as far as an examination that you did?
I guess one of the most news-related cases would be the shooting of the two students at Southern University. I guess that was one that I can think of. That was, of course, was and I I was very much involved in that.
International story at that time.
That offhand, that would be about the mm-hmm. first one I think about, Jim. But there were plenty of other ones, too.
I recall the late Ed Reed saying that he was writing a book, Requiem for a Kingfish, about the assassination of Huey Long, And in those days, it was a bit different as far as getting records. He just went to you, and you supplied him with Huey Long's records.
Well, that's
Lady of the Lake, right?
That's true. Ed asked me, and I went to the Lady of the Lake, and the sisters were very cooperative, and they gave me the original records of it. And I copied those to give them to Ed, and I thought I had the originals, and I do not know where they are now.
Oh, my goodness. You threw away a fortune there.
Well, if I had them, I'd give them to his family, but I do not know when I left the coroner's office where they are.
But there was much conjecture about Huey Long's death, and Ed Reed came to the conclusion that the bodyguards did it. Did you actually look at the records?
Well, I don't have any thought on that, Jim, as to what had happened. I wasn't around then. I think whatever the historians say is okay. You can read five books and you get five different answers, you know. So you have to make up your own mind as to what happened, I think.
It's amazing how I've had guests on this show, Dr. Landry, who have been near death, and they've talked about how people don't want to discuss death. Mike Dunn, I remember the journalist vividly sitting right in the chair you are, and he mentioned as he was in his dying days that no one really wanted to talk about death, but yet we're still fascinated about death, like the JFK assassination and others. It's interesting how we compress information and live with the world as we know it, which is always uncertain.
That's very true, very true.
So how did you do it? Here you see all these people coming in as coroner who are dead, and you're alive and well, and you have many years to go, but you can't think about corpses all day long.
Well, again, Jim, everybody, when you they know me and they meet me and they knew I've been the coroner for so long, that's the first thing they say, you know, something about the dead people. But really, that's only a part of the coroner's office. I spent 8 hours a day in the office seeing patients, seeing people that had problems. A lot of people had problems with drugs. Their families were either using drugs or suicidal or homicidal. And we would pick those people up and examine them and get them in the proper hospitals. And so I, out of my 24 hours in a day, I would spend very, very little time looking at a dead body, for example. I mean, if I did an autopsy,
you've seen more than I have.
Well, yeah, I've seen a lot more than you. But I've also been real busy doing everything else that the coroner's office demands that you do, too.
And you've been to places I'll never go, and you got to examine Elvis Presley.
Yeah, big deal.
Yeah, he was about 6 foot, I would guess he was overweight when you examined him, probably over 200 pounds.
I didn't pay any attention to it. He was very nice to me, and that never entered my mind about him if he was overweight or anything.
Well, you're not overweight, and no. I think you've got many more great years, and happy 88th birthday.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure being on your show. You do a great job for the community, and I want to give you the accolades that you deserve. You do a lot for us, for Baton Rouge, and I really appreciate it. I'm a great fan of yours, and I'll be listening to you on your new thing when you leave here, Jim.
Well, thank you, Dr. Landry. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by Steve Almond. We heard from him a few weeks ago and got such interesting response that we have him back. He spent 7 years as a journalist in Texas and in Florida before writing his first book, a short story collection, My Life in Heavy Metal. His nonfiction book, Candy Freak, was a New York Times bestseller. He's also a former sports reporter and play-by-play man, and that is relevant because his latest work is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Good morning again, Steve Almond.
Good to be with you.
Well, you believe that football is not good for us. Not good for the players, not good for the fans, not good for our cities or our culture.
Yeah. I have to tell you, Jim, I was absolutely shocked, as I'm sure you were, to read on Friday that the NFL itself has admitted in their federal court documents that one-third of their players suffer the risk they anticipate will get long-term cognitive ailments. That to me is a very shocking figure. It wasn't something I expected at all. you know, for years, the NFL and the NCAA have really tried to obscure how dangerous the game is to its players. But just imagine that we now have a workplace, the NFL, where literally 30% of the players are going to get some form of brain damage from doing their job. And that strikes me as pretty shocking.
One-third, you say?
30%, yeah. So there's this lawsuit that I'm sure you know about where 5,000 former NFL players filed suit against the NFL, and they weren't just seeking medical benefits. They were accusing the league of covering up the link between playing the game of football and the cognitive problems that players were experiencing later in their lives, guys like Junior Seau and Mike Webster and so forth. And they actually, the NFL had some actuarial statistics that they turned into the court, and it was the NFL's own statistics that indicated that they anticipate 30% of former players are going to experience some form of long-term cognitive problem. That felt to me like a very shocking figure. I know everybody's very consumed with Ray Rice matter and Adrian Peterson, but to say that there's a workplace in 2014 in America where a third of the employees, or nearly a third, are going to suffer long-term cognitive ailment, it felt to me quite shocking. I was absolutely floored by that news.
Well, and another aspect of the game that will take time to tell is that now the players are bigger, as in much bigger, as in 350
Correct.
Pounds in many cases. Over time, you would think that this might shorten a person's life.
Yeah, I think they've actually found. So one of the things they suggest in Against Football, and Jim, I think I've told you before, I'm a huge fan of the game. I've been a fan for 40 years. I admire its grace, its beauty, the courage of the players. You know, it's not, my book is nothing more than a kind of heartbroken lament at how dangerous the game has become and the sort of economic greed that's grown up around it. It's that money motive, I think, that causes the players to want to get paid at every level. You got high school players now. I'm sure you have a bunch in Louisiana who are essentially over 300 pounds, and that's bigger than the pros were, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. So mass times acceleration equals force. These guys are hitting one another with much more force. The problem is that the brain remains a soft organ, you know, in the skull, which is a hard shell. And when these guys hit one another with such force, the brain's being smashed up against the inside of their skull. There's nothing to be done about that.
Well, I'm old enough to remember Jim Brown, who may have been the greatest football player of them all, and he had a reputation for beating up women. And in fact, Johnny Carson once said the NFL season opened Sunday and Jim Brown threw out the first girl.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, that's back in the news with Ray Rice, but obviously football players for years have been violent on and off the field. And yeah. Is the Ray Rice case enough to sink the commissioner of the league?
You know, that's a really good question. The problem is, not the problem, the situation is very complicated. Roger Goodell has been a very good commissioner of the NFL, by which I mean that he's done his job, and his job is to grow the profits of the NFL. They made nearly $10 billion in revenues last year, and his goal ultimately is to have the league make $25 billion a year, which is really Nike money. That's like McDonald's money. And he's done a very good job at increasing the size of the fan base, getting women involved as fans. The problem is that he also has this huge optics problem, which is that his players are now associated with not just violence against women, but violence against children now with Adrian Peterson. And fundamentally, if you take a step back from the game, the gender roles that are portrayed are pretty stark. I mean, women are essentially defined by the game as sexual ornaments whose job is to jiggle on the sidelines, and men are defined as big, strong guys who, to be effective in the world, you know, physically dominate other players. That's their job. So it's really hard to have those kind of gender roles, which aren't the gender roles of 2014 America, off the gridiron. You know, you have guys who are aggressive and violent, and they're paid a lot of money to be savage at the point of attack and so forth. You can't expect those players to step off the gridiron, and the moment they step over the chalk line, Jim, they're suddenly gentlemen role models. That's really not how human beings function.
And Roger Goodell makes more than any player, $44 million last year.
That's right, but that really keys into what I was saying earlier, which is that he's made that much money because of incentives. He's made that much money because he's made the owners even more money. So it's a very complicated situation. The owners are very loyal to him because he's enriched them tremendously by hundreds of millions of dollars.
And at the same time, they recognize that even as he's drawn women in as fans, you can't put pink cleats on the, you know, on the players and expect that's going to be enough to really solve this intractable problem, which is that football is really woefully out of date in the way that it portrays gender in terms of 2014 America. It's a kind of a toxic relationship. And I don't even think getting rid of Roger Goodell, throwing him under the bus, is really going to address that fundamental issue.
Now, as fans, and in some cases, including yours truly, people who own businesses that benefit from football, what should we do?
Well, my book is not an attempt to say boycott the NFL or abolish the NFL. My book is an attempt to say I was a fan for 40 years. I love this game. I love these players and, you know, the fact that they can create miracles with their bodies and their will and their intelligence and their athleticism. And I'm heartbroken that I can no longer sit in front of a game and not feel that I'm really complicit in something that doesn't line up with my values as a citizen or as a parent of two daughters and a son. And my personal decision was to say I have to step away from the game and put my time and energy and passion and money in some other activity that I don't feel so morally troubled by. But I'm not interested in fans. You know, fans should do as their own consciences recommend. My book is just trying to say I love the game, and I also recognize that the game has these profound moral hazards. And if you agree with me about, you know, that these exist, then you should think about that before you sort of mindlessly go and watch the game or just watch it for its entertainment value without recognizing that some of these guys are going to wind up with brain damage at a very young age. You know, the league is making tons of money partly off of the taxpayers. You know, all these things that I think have a huge negative impact, and still that doesn't mean the games are any less stirring or exciting. That's really the crisis that my book's trying to set out. What happens when you love something that you also know is in some ways against your values and bad for your, you know, your family, your community? I wouldn't put my daughters, for instance, in front of a football game because it would send the message to them that their job is to sort of be a sexual ornament, and that's not how I want to raise them.
Against Football, from Steve Almond, called by one reviewer America's biggest sacred cow, football. Now, you draw a parallel with boxing and Howard Cosell. He called the fight, I remember it, with Larry Holmes and Tex Cobb. And he was so distressed at the beating that Cobb took. He did go the distance with Holmes, by the way. But Cosell said he would never call another fight. And you write he never did. And Cosell may have been a raging egotist and a shameless grandstander, but he was also a rarity in the blinkered guild of sportscasters, a man not afraid to draw his own line.
Yeah.
So,
well, to some extent, as a member of the media, I guess that's what I would call myself, you know, there is a sense in which I feel a certain kind of complicity myself when I write about football, unless I'm treating it as a moral activity. And that's what Howard Cosell was doing. And it was a very odd, striking moment. He was saying, Howard Cosell, as a human being, am morally troubled by the beating that I'm witnessing. And I don't want to be party to a sport that would allow that. I should mention, by the way, you know, boxing was our most popular sport in the United States a century ago. And the reason that it became less popular hasn't disappeared. There are even more violent forms of it. I recognize that. But the reason it went from being our biggest sport, like football is now, to a more minor sport is because individuals had the same reaction as Howard Cosell. They said, the brutality and risk of this sport is too much for me to be able to watch in good conscience.
Now, you mentioned taxpayers, and in Louisiana, we know all about this because our state,
yes, you do.
Whether you live in New Orleans or New Roads or Lake Providence or anywhere else in the state, you're going to pay taxes to help Tom Benson, a billionaire who owns the New Orleans Saints, and that's designed to keep him from taking his marbles and going somewhere else. Is that fair to the taxpayers of Louisiana and other states?
I don't think it is. I mean, taxpayers have spent more than $1 billion to help him build the stadium. I don't think it is, but then again, they've got us by the short hairs here, Jim, because, you know, you guys love your Saints down there. And the fact of the matter is that these owners use the fans' passion. They use our athletic devotion to the game as a kind of engine of greed. This happens all across the country. 70% of the money that is paid for stadiums, football stadiums, is supplied by the taxpayers. The taxpayers do not see a return of 70% on that investment. They don't see a return of 50% or 25% or 10%. They see nearly nothing. They essentially hand over public tax dollars that could be used for, you know, silly stuff like schools, law enforcement, infrastructure. That money is handed to a set of billionaire owners to help them put on football games, and we do not, as the taxpayers, see any of the benefit of that. In fact, we even supply the infrastructure. It's kind of the circus mentality, and I recognize that there is an economic benefit to having a football team, and there's a communal benefit. People rally around the team. They have a sense of identification. Those things are very real, but it's also true that these owners, by and large, could afford to build their own stadiums that they're profiting by, and I think one of the things I suggest at the end of the book, they should have to. I don't think the public should be stuck with the bill for building a giant stadium or pay $6 million a year just in an incentive fee to keep the Saints around. The NFL owners are playing this game. It's called franchise free agency, where they play cities off against one another and say, hey, listen, you don't want to pay enough money to supply the stadium. Your taxpayers don't want the team that much. We'll move them. We'll move them to Houston, or we'll move them to LA, or we'll move them to whatever city is desperate for a franchise. And I think that's really cynical, to play cities and fans off against one, you know, off each other like that.
You also take note of the explosion of dollars in collegiate athletics, noting that ESPN paid $7.3 billion to broadcast the newly implemented college football playoffs for the next 12 years.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, and to me, that's even more profoundly troubling, because if you think about it, the NCAA is essentially an athletic institution that is our body, a governing body, that's connected to the educational mission of this country. And to me, if I had a student at LSU, I guess I might want them to have a good football team, but I would want them even more profoundly to have a good anthropology department or epidemiology, you know, school of medicine that was doing great work in epidemiology. Those are the fundamental things that we support state universities for, and the reason we grant them tax-exempt status, that they're going to educate the next generation of Americans, not that they're going to have a great football team that's going to be, you know, ranked number one. I understand that's very exciting, and that means a lot to fans, but I wonder if it should mean more than their education.
You note that in the SEC, schools spend nearly 12 times as much on athletes as they do on students who came to study engineering or epidemiology. And colleges with big football programs spend hundreds of million dollars on big stadiums, sometimes subsidized by taxpayers. Now, in LSU's case, the money has been raised privately, and LSU has the ninth largest arena in the world. But people will give for a football program, for an athletic program, who will never give to the university.
And that's a very true and profound point, Jim, and there's no dispute about that. But what I would say is that it's also tremendously expensive to support a football program. You know, Alabama a couple of years ago spent, I think, $34 million. There's a lot of recruiting visits. There's a lot of, you know, the coach is usually the highest paid employee at the university. And you're right that it's a giant economic engine. To me, the question is, what are our colleges for? What are our high schools for? Fundamentally, what do we want those institutions in our culture to be? Because really what the NCAA has become is a developmental league for the pros. The NFL is the one that's benefiting from the development of players like Johnny Manziel, or even going back a few years, you know, Jamarcus Russell. I know that's not a popular name, but he was on my team, the Oakland Raiders. So, you know, the NCAA is essentially a developmental league for the NFL. They make these guys into star players, and they make millions and millions, billions of dollars for the networks and the sponsors. But that's definitely a huge economic engine. The question is whether it should be attached to our system of higher education, or should it exist as a developmental league like in baseball, where it's just the minor leagues?
Well, you say football has also been a boon for the military. How so?
I think that football, for one thing, they recruit, but I think a lot of the mentality that we apply to football is the same mentality we apply to soldiers. And I mean by that we lionize them rightfully for their courage and their valor. But when they come back from an overseas conflict, or they retire and it's 10 or 20 years down the road from football, we don't really as a society want to have to look at the ways in which they're physically and psychically disfigured. And I've talked to a lot of former football players. Those guys are in pain virtually all the time. And some of them now, we're finding up to a third of them are going to be struggling with cognitive difficulties. You know, I had the experience of seeing my mom, you know, struggle with an acute dementia, and it absolutely haunted me and continues to haunt me. So it's a little bit more real for me when we talk about Junior Seau or Mike Webster or Dave Durson at the end of his life. The reality is that we ask an incredible amount of these young men, whether they're soldiers or they're football players, and I don't think we have the same concern about them once they're out of the limelight.
We've got a role, Steve, but it's a compelling read, Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.